Here's a surprising fact. Matching the most exclusive club in the world of judges, the nine justices of the U.S. Supreme Court, it turns out there is a matching club of very exclusive lawyers, a small group of highly experienced attorneys who argue many, if not most, of the cases before the Supremes, as insiders call them. A Reuters investigation found that it boils down to a group of just 66 lawyers and eight really big attorneys who, in the 9 years Reuters looked at, were far more likely to get heard out of the pool of 17,000 private attorneys who petitioned the court in that time. Joining us is Joan Biskupic, editor-in-charge of legal affairs at Reuters. Joan, welcome to The Takeaway.
Hi, John. Thanks.
So, Ms. Biskupic, how exclusive is this club here, and what kinds of cases are we talking about?
Well, we're talking about men, and they're mostly men, who control about half of the Supreme Court's docket. As you mentioned, we looked at 17,000 lawyers, more than 10,000 petitions that had come into the Supreme Court over the last 9 years, to isolate first on who was most successful at getting their cases even accepted for review by the justices. I think some of your listeners, John, might not be aware of what a heavy lift it is to even get a case before the Supreme Court. The justices have virtually complete discretion over which cases they take. So, and they get thousands and thousands to their marble doorsteps each year. But there is an elite core that's very successful at that. And then we also looked at who is most successful in terms of just arguing before the justices, that most prominent role, standing at the lectern in that wonderful marble and red velvet setting. And we isolated down to the big eight before the black-robed nine.
So this eight group of attorneys that are the elite of the elite, who do they represent?
Mainly corporations. That was the other thing we decided to look at, is of these successful lawyers who tend to be coming to the court much more than at any other period, who are they primarily representing? And first, for the most successful 66 lawyers who get their cases accepted, 51 worked for law firms that primarily represented corporate interests. And we found, John, that in cases pitting the interests of consumers, employees, or other individuals against those of companies, a leading attorney was three times more likely to launch an appeal on behalf of business than on behalf of an individual.
And this benefits an exclusive, narrow list of law firms. Is that right?
That's right. And see, what we were trying to get at was whether certain lawyers and clients have a disproportionate chance to influence the law of the land. Now, what the justices will say, and rightly say, is that, first of all, they want experienced lawyers. That makes complete sense. And they also want strong lawyers on both sides. And what they said was, even though there might be more of these very polished inside the club lawyers appearing on behalf of corporations, there are plenty of lawyers on the other side, for example, with law school clinics and small law firms. And we talked to those lawyers who are prominent in their own right, but they can only do so much, they said. And the other thing I should mention is that we acknowledge that the business of litigation is often business. Think of all the individuals who bring workplace, environmental, and consumer cases against the court. Collectively speaking, those individuals are left to a smaller pool of lawyers who, again, collectively speaking, have a lower success rate. And the other thing, John, is it's not just the strength of the corporate tilt that we were able to identify, but also the deepening insularity. Many of these individuals have worked inside the court. They were law clerks to the justices, or they came from the prestigious office of the U.S. Solicitor General, which represents the federal government before the court.
So is that to say that a case like Gideon versus Wainwright, which established the doctrine of a right to an attorney and a representation by an attorney, which I believe began with a petitioner from inside a prison, is
yes.
unheard of today?
No, it's not unheard of, and that was a very famous petition. The inmate wrote it on behalf of himself, and we still will have cases coming up pro se, which means that the individual is trying to represent himself, and we have inmates that will, on occasion, get their cases accepted. But what we isolated on were the private attorney cases. We decided to, frankly, exclude all the criminal appeals in that way and just look at, if you're going to pay to have a case up there, if you're going to represent someone in the normal course of business, who do you go to? And are those individual lawyers who clients seem to be focusing on more, do they have an edge before the justices? Mm-hmm. And the justices say, No, we're not looking at the names on the petition. We're just looking at the quality of the lawyering. We're not trying to say we definitely want a petition, for example, from a Ted Olson or a Seth Waxman, two individuals who are very successful before this court. But they're beginning to rely on really high-quality lawyering, which has led us to the conclusion that it seems like the justices have essentially added a new criterion to their screening, and that's not only the merits of the legal issue, but the merits of the lawyering.
So it's kind of like a Broadway audition, in addition to being a evaluation of the merits of the particular case. What influence on the law do you think this has? And if we widen this out to include law schools and figure that the elite probably mostly come from Harvard, Yale, Stanford, and the big law schools, does this restrict the diversity of arguments and the sort of precedents that the court is establishing here in the Roberts era?
Well, what many critics say goes to exactly your point there in the question, John, is that what we have now is a group of elite justices, and all of them did attend either Harvard or Yale, being presented with cases by men and women, and again, it is mostly men, who've gone to elite schools, and that the conversation has narrowed, that it's, as I said, an echo chamber, which is the term we used for this series, that instead of broader themes of democracy, it's narrower, more technical arguments, you know, for better or worse, and how frankly, diversity of all types has been eliminated. I'm not just talking racial diversity or ethnic diversity, but also regional diversity and a range of voices. Of those 66 lawyers who were most successful, capturing 43% of the cases that the court chose to decide from 2004 to 2012, of those 66, 63 were white and only 8 were women.
Joan Biskupic is editor-in-charge for legal affairs at Reuters. The investigation they did of the lawyering before the Supreme Court is called Echo Chamber. Thank you very much.
Thanks, John.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, The New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for The New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.